Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. And greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. This is where the past meets the future. The solar wind tonight is 411 kilometers per second. There are no sunspots, as little sunspot 1014 has faded away. Maybe something on the other side of the sun knows what's going on here. Where is solar cycle 24? A slight coronal hole is sending a solar wind to Earth. Should arrive about Wednesday, so that will be your best chance for an aurora in the North Countries. NASA has announced a tentative launch date for a space shuttle Discovery, March 11th at 9:20 Eastern Daylight Time. The spectacular night launch will mark the beginning of a two-week mission to the International Space Station, where astronauts will add a new pair of solar wings to power the growing spaceport. The timing of the launch, if it goes off as planned, is favorable for North American sky watchers who will be able to see the International Space Station and Discovery flying in tandem through the night sky. By the way, for those of you living in western United States, that's just before 7 a.m. in the morning. If you're awake, have a look outside. You'll be able to see it. It'll be a minus 2.4 on the scale, which is very, very bright, brighter than Venus. NASA's Stereo B spacecraft has spotted a coronal hole over the sun's eastern limb. Soon, that hole will turn to face Earth, and it will send a stronger solar wind stream in our direction. So, you Arctic sky watchers, be ready. And also, this just in, NASA budget stands to gain a $600 million boost if the $825 billion economic stimulus bill introduced January 15th in the U.S. House of Representatives becomes law. That means that suddenly the government is very interested in what is going on down here on Earth. Somebody is watching you. The Kepler spacecraft lifted off at 10:49 p.m. Friday night. It will watch a patch of space for 3.5 years or more for signs of Earth-sized planets moving around stars similar to our sun. The patch that Kepler will watch contains about 100,000 stars like the sun. Using special detectors similar to those used in digital cameras, Kepler will look for a slight dimming in the stars as planets pass between the stars and Kepler. The observatory's place in space will allow it to watch the same stars constantly throughout its mission, something observatories such as NASA's Hubble Space Telescope cannot do. Hey, how would you like to impress your sky-watching friends? It's easy. All you have to do is subscribe to Heavens Above and look for the scheduled orbits of the International Space Station. If you haven't watched this amazing craft fly over the sky once every 2 hours, you haven't been amazed lately. February 2nd, and I think also March 10th, it will fly over in North America at just before 7 a.m. in the morning. And this time it'll have the Space Shuttle Discovery attached to it. You'll definitely want to check that out. It's way bigger than you ever thought it could be. Hey, I have a special guest tonight with me. As you know, if you visited the website at X Squared Radio, a rare opportunity has come up. at the 2012 Quantum Leap Conference in Burbank, California, this coming weekend. If you're in the Bay Area, if you're anywhere within an hour's drive or so of Los Angeles, or you're going to be visiting there this next weekend, stop in and visit this conference. The leaders of that conference are here with us tonight. Sriram Kaur and his lovely wife, and I can't remember her name. I'm sure they're on right now, so she'll tell me. How are you?
We are delighted to share this moment with you, and I'm Kira Raw.
Yeah, what she said.
Yeah, just Sri and Kira is simple enough, and you know, it's great fun to be with you tonight. Thank you for having us.
This is so much fun. About, I'm going to say 2.5 years ago, I was at a Conscious Life Expo in Los Angeles, and Sriram Kaur was giving both of them were giving a workshop there in some very neat Merkaba energy, and I was privileged to watch that workshop. Very impressive amount of energy that they deliver to people. So tell us a little bit about the conference coming up.
Well, thanks for asking. You know, Kira and I have authored 3 books on the 2012 topic, and this exploration of what is in front of us as a humanity has been igniting passion within us, because we recognize we're at a unique time in our history. And in our latest book, 2012 Awakenings, we talk about how we're at an era of spiritual awakening, and if we don't embrace that, then we may be at an era of our Armageddon.
And you know what's so wonderful, as I'm sure you know and as you're sharing, is that we are at a very special moment. You know, we're at this moment of coagulation in so many different ways, and the opportunity to come together, to meet together, and to birth a new paradigm in coming together is the reason that we agreed to say, okay, yes, let's bring this forward. And we were given very clear guidance that this event had to happen in the first quarter of 2009 because of all of the energies that are coming forward this year, and that it had to premiere on a day that would bust all paradigms. So, of course, that's why we picked Friday the 13th to be the first night.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I forgot all about that. I bet most people did.
Yeah.
And you know, Sony Pictures is releasing a movie this fall simply entitled 2012. And it is a multi-million dollar blockbuster designed to scare the bejesus out of you.
You know, it's basically saying, let's pervade human consciousness with even more fear. And because fear has become so profitable, there's a lot of fear being marketed out there right now. And so the gift of this conference is that this, we're terming it a passionate action celebration, so that people like yourself, George Norrie, Sri and I, William Henry, Don Jose Ruiz, so many other beings who are coming together, we're coming together to collectively say, you know, enough is enough. We are here on this planet. It's more than just any one person's game at this point. And how can we come together and maybe start a wave of energy around the planet that says, enough with being fear-based. We're going to channel our energies into something that will actually give our children a beautiful world to thrive in.
And Kira, that's exactly the energy that I felt from you guys about 2.5 years ago, and what I feel from you now. It's you know, we go to these conferences, and of course we speak at them and we present at them, but we also get to watch the other presenters and the other speakers.
Yes.
And you hit the nail on the head. There are so many who really have sold, you know, tens of millions of books based on fear. And
yes,
it's not so much that the public buys into it, it's just the energy of it is so attractive. It's like a big science fiction show for them. But what they don't realize is this is real.
Exactly, yes.
We're conditioned consciousness, and whether we do it consciously or unconsciously, we are part of the outcome.
And you bet. When
we can hold a higher frequency of positive visioning, of just positive expectation, even without a target, just that sense of joy, we will call to ourselves a more harmonious circumstance.
You know, one of the things that I learned, and I have to jump in here, because one of the things I learned, you know, I died of cancer in 1989. I was clinically dead for 4 minutes on the table. And one of the things that I learned in my near-death experience, and I'm so grateful for, is that if you are on this planet, because you chose this planet, among other planets, if you are on this planet at this moment in a time frame that you chose to visit, you're here because you're part of this collective experience that we are already in the middle of that has a vast energetic underpinning that will come to an extraordinary crescendo in 2012. And so what do you want? And how do you want to bring it forward? And this is why in all of our books on 2012, from our guidance from the Archangelic Realm, from our guidance from the Maya, from all of the guidance that we bring forward, it's about what do you want to do? Do you want to empower a negative prophecy? And this is what you were just saying, Brooks, is that there's this fascination with the science fiction, yet this is as real as it comes because you're the co-creator. So no matter what's happening in your life, no matter what's happening in your life right now, the good news is you're an amazing co-creator. Just where do you want to channel the energy?
And so what we try to tell people to do from this station is turn the cable news off.
Yay!
Every 30 minutes, they are ringing the bell of fear, and it's going around and around and around and feeding on itself. And if you don't believe me, and you live in the Los Angeles area, and you're either out of work, underemployed, or afraid you're going to be unemployed, you might need a little joy and hope in your life. Make your way out to the 2012 Quantum Leap Conference in Burbank at the, I believe it's at the Marriott Hotel at the airport, and you will have yourself lifted. Just go to the website, 2012quantumleap.com, right?
That's it,
yeah.
And look at the roster of speakers. These are not the fearmongers. These are the messengers of hope that are out there.
Well, we really appreciate you sharing that with everyone. And, you know, I couldn't agree with you more that, you know, even if you're not sure, you know, even if you're not sure what you're looking for, come. Come and give yourself, you know, one of the experiences that I'm so excited about this weekend is that, do you know there's healing rooms and they're free? So let's say you just had a beautiful experience and you say, let me go see what a sound healing is. Let me go experience an Egyptian healing rod experience. Let me go get a balancing. This is all part of the weekend. People have come in literally from all over the world to say, we're going to create a model for coming together that's going to demonstrate what we are ready to bring forward on our planet right now. And the power of co-creative community offers you safety. It offers you a gift of relaxation and an opportunity to really touch your soul in a whole new way.
You know, I like the word free, but these things do cost money to put on. However, you have some introductory pricing that people need to be made aware of. And if you need more information on that, you can always click on the 2012 Quantum Leap banner at X Squared Radio, and that pricing is available to you as a listener to X Squared Radio. But why don't you explain it to our listeners?
Well, thank you. We have three tiers, you might say, of ticket prices that make it available to people from all cash availability bases, everything from $175 down to $59. Now, the key here is that your admission price is for three full days. So literally from $20 a day to $50 a day, depending upon what seating you would like, you can have an experience that will not only give you skills for the new era, but will delight your corpuscles.
You know, I love that. And I have to share with the tickets also that, you know, we also have these amazing fusion artists headed up by Rasuli that are literally going to be painting, creating the painting of the energy of the weekend all weekend long. So you're actually part of that creative process in many different ways. As I mentioned with your ticket, all the healing rooms are free. There's just so much to do. It's one of those events you need to bring your family, bring your friends, and we even have a group room that if you have a special group or you guys want to get together and do your own thing, you can even go there, and that's even included in your ticket.
How about that? So there you have it, Earth Explorers. Delight your corpuscles. Somewhere in the Bay Area, actually, namely at the Marriott Hotel, at the Burbank Airport, and if you live in the Los Angeles area, it's less than an hour's drive out there, especially on a Friday afternoon or early Saturday morning. Come out and get your corpuscles delighted, and don't think that you're going to leave with a workshop high. You're going to leave with tools and an experience that will change your life.
And it's through that energy that you will radiate a new presence in your home and in your community, and this is how we co-create a new world.
We can use it. So let's get going, creators. Thank you both so much for coming on, and I look forward to being on your program Wednesday afternoon, Wednesday evening. And we sent out an announcement to many, many thousands of Earth Explorer listeners at X Squared Radio this morning about your conference, and we're going to try and fill it up so we can have more of these, because we've got to get something going in this country that's positive and light and cheerful.
Thank you for taking action, because together we can make a difference.
And Brooks, we are grateful, as we are grateful to everyone listening right now to this extraordinary show. The more we can support each other on this journey, the more beautiful a world we create.
My gratitude as well. Thank you both so much.
And thank you.
All right. We will talk to you later.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, Earth Explorers, we will take about a one-minute break here. It's just going to be a little piece of music. We're going to try and get Walter Cruttenden on the phone. If you are familiar with his book, The Lost Star, you're going to be amazed. This is going to be an interview that you will not want to walk away from, and you'll want to play it over and over again. We'll be back in about 1 minute with Walter Cruttenden. Okay. All right, Earth Explorers, we now have Walter Cruttenden on the line with us. Walter, how are you doing? Oh, man, this has been an amazing day. It started out with the overcast, then it got sunshiny, and then it snowed. And so we're back in the frozen wasteland of western Idaho. How's the weather where you are?
Well, I'm down south of Palm Springs in the desert, and it's been mid-70s all day. It's pretty nice.
Well, wonderful. The subject of precession and the realization of history in the 2012 events is filling paranormal headlines all over the world. But you have managed to put together a work of such scope and sensibility that I wanted to bring you on the program and talk about what we should be paying attention to concerning the next few years. In your book, Lost Star, you lay out a very nice order of knowledge about the subject of precession. How did you first become interested in this subject?
Well, when I was a little boy, I was always interested in history, and my mom used to get me all sorts of books on it, and I read about these great ancient civilizations, but when I got to school, they kind of passed over all the early civilizations, Sumeria, Indus Valley, that sort of thing, very quickly. And they just painted this linear picture that going from caveman to modern man, pretty much, you know, without a lot of down spots in it. And it just didn't make sense to me, so I was always searching in the back of my mind for a better explanation. And when I came across first the Indian or sort of Vedic teachings of this idea of a cycle, it made a lot of sense. And, you know, they basically say that history moves in this vast cycle of time with alternating dark and golden ages. And Plato called it the great year. And in fact, it's not just the Indians and the Greeks, but since I've started my research, I've found out there's about 30 ancient cultures that talked about this cycle. There's a book on it called Hamlet's Mill by Giorgio De Santayana, who was the former professor of the history science at MIT. And he's documented these cultures and over 200 myths related to it, and really Ruxa, it runs from Nordic countries all the way down to Polynesians and, of course, all the classic Mediterranean cultures that we've become aware of through history. And they don't, you know, they're not all super specific, but they all are alluding to this changing of the heavens caused this changing of consciousness or time or history here on planet Earth. And so,
that's kind of something that has fascinated me because, and I'm sure many people think about this, the heavens don't move very quickly. And we look at it with telescopes and satellites. The ancients just sort of laid on their back on a rock. How did they know that the precession was actually happening? It takes a long time for any changes to happen up there, right?
It does, yeah. I think our current theory of history is that they were just primitive and laid on a rock and didn't do much. But however they did it, they did notice this slow change. You know, we basically, astronomers talk about three motions of the Earth now. That's what Copernicus said. It spins on its axis, and so that causes us to see the stars and the sun, you know, rise in the east and set in the west every day. And then, of course, the Earth goes around the sun in its annual orbit, and that causes us to see the stars slowly go overhead, you know, throughout the year as a different constellation is at the zenith of the sky. But they notice this third motion, which actually goes in reverse to the other two. So instead of a procession of stars, it's a precession. And it is so slow and so subtle. It's only 1 degree every 72 years. But a lot of them talk about it or make reference to it. And, you know, I'm convinced they knew about it long before Hipparchus, and Giorgio says the same thing.
Well, I mean, can't help but wonder, if it moves 1 degree in 72 years, the average lifespan of the ancients, and I'm not talking about Noah's lifespan, but certainly you know, lifespans that we're familiar with in times without clean water and, you know, refrigeration, so to speak, the average lifespan wasn't 72 years. It was substantially shorter than that. So, you know, how did, you know, one astronomer, one sky observer come up with the idea that we're going to overlay these stars with animals and gods? And what goes where? I mean, what makes up an animal in the sky and where the gods are located?
Well, there's hundreds of myths about the stars in, you know, various constellations. And the most well-known, of course, are the 12 zodiac constellations that lie along the ecliptic there within, you know, 8 degrees on either side. And they used it as a sort of a timekeeping system. Not only, you know, the months of the year, but this epochs or periods within the great year. And so some of this comes down to us through myth and folklore, and some of it's resurrected again, like this modern saying, you know, sort of the dawning of the age of Aquarius that became popular again with the Hair musical in the 60s. That's a reference to this changing of the stars, this very slow motion, and the changing of consciousness or history that goes along with it.
Well, now we're going to talk about this more tonight because one of the really great revelations that you get in this book, The Lost Star, when we talk about precession, I should say when everybody else talks about precession, they talk about a fixed amount of time in between each one of these signs of the zodiac, like we're leaving Pisces right now and entering Aquarius. And that happens just like hours on a clock, but it doesn't, does it?
No, there's a lot of room for interpretation there. One is, you know, where do you start and where do you end a constellation? Do you use the first star and the last star? Another is, you know, the point of the equinox. The ancients actually used the autumnal equinox, most of the evidence we can find, and the Indians still do today, whereas in the West we use the vernal equinox to keep time. And the whole cycle is a little bit variable. Astronomers now put it at about 25,700 years for one complete precession equinox, the time that it takes standing on the equinox, viewing the stars, for the all 12 zodiac signs to go around. But it's changing slightly, and so there's estimates from 24 to 26,000 years that the cycle would actually take. And most of the ancients used 24,000. And interestingly, when we look at our clocks today, we have these periods of time, 12 hours of a.m. and 12 hours of p.m., to make up 24-hour day. This seems to be a microcosm of this idea of a great year, where you have 12,000 years of an ascending cycle and 12,000 years of a descending cycle for a 24,000-year cycle in total.
Well, are they all equal, or, as you allude to in your book, is our solar system under forces outside our heliosphere that that really throw an interesting twist that explains a lot of the anomalies in precession? What's going on?
Well, no, each sign, if it takes 25,700 years, then each sign is roughly, you know, 2,160 years or something like that. But the ancients would tell you that it's better to use 2,000 years per sign as an estimate. You know, this is a celestial clock, so it's just sort of a guide to telling long-term time.
There are many ancient civilizations that speak about this precession. They write about it. They left it in their artwork and their architecture. From whom do the best records come?
I think the Vedic culture, the Indians, you know, the people of the Indus Valley there, when Alexander met them, lived along the Indus River, he called them Indus. Today we call them Hindus. And they have a body of work that they kept by oral tradition for thousands of years. And it's been written down, you know, the last few thousand, some of it, not just to the last few hundred, which we call the Vedas. And there's they talk about the cycle and put it back to at least Manu, the great Indian legislator. And that's about, according to Paramahansa Yogananda, Manu lived during the last golden age, which ended about 7,000 B.C. or so. Now, classical historian scholars really wouldn't accept that date or up until a couple years ago, because it was pretty much determined that anything before 5,000 years ago, you know, was just a hunter-gatherer society. But with the finding of, you know, in the Bay of Cambay or Caral Peru, or, you know, this wonderful find at Göbekli Tepe, Turkey, that goes back to 10 to 12,000 years old, people are more open now to believing, okay, maybe they really were accounting for these things, 7,000 years ago. Maybe there's some truth to this.
Well, it's one thing to go back to that civilization and say, okay, now here we are in, what do we call it, you know, 2009. It's easy to go back to then and see a difference between then and now, because we're talking about a degree every 72 years. So we can see the progression. But how did they see the progression? That must have meant that there were ancient civilizations before them that kept good records, or they got the information from somewhere else.
I totally agree with you, Brooks. It's a it's an odd situation now. Our view of history is very myopic because we tend to be a very skeptical society where we throw out a lot of the ancient writings themselves. So there were at least five Greeks that said civilization is several hundred thousand years old. But because we don't find a lot of stuff, which is mostly because nothing really lasts if it's been exposed for, you know, 5 or 10,000 years, even stone, that we assume that it must have, there just must be nothing, that all these histories must be wrong. But needless to say, I think there's something to gather
the same thing. You know, when we come across things like cuneiform writing, which, you know, isn't a haphazard scratching on a cave wall. It's a very sophisticated language, very precise in mathematics and astronomy, and we don't really see a precursor language out there. This is a finished, refined communication system that existed, what, 25,000 years ago?
Well, I think most of the tablets, the oldest they'll date them is about 5,000 to 5,500 years ago in Mesopotamia, going back to Sumer, Akkad, that period of time.
But if you
look at this whole idea of the yugas, it's explained, you know, that in higher ages, supposedly, and let me break down the ages just a little bit, and I'll use the Greek terms because they're the easiest to understand. They give us the iron is the lowest age, then the bronze, then the silver, and then the golden age. So those four, it takes 12,000 years to go through that ascending arc. And then the descending order, you go back down through golden, silver, bronze, and iron. And the Indian culture had, you know, an identical process, but they called it the Kali Yuga for the lowest, and then the Dwapara, Treta, and Satya Yuga is the highest. Well, it's easy to understand ages that are lower than us because our consciousness is greater than the consciousness at the time. But we have really no conception of periods higher than us. So if you're talking about a pre-Babel age, an age before writing, you know, we can hardly conceive of it. We read a little bit of myth about it. You know, even the Bible says that's before God confused the tongues, that mankind communed, spoke with one tongue and communed with nature. Hesiod talks about it as just a beautiful time when mankind lived easily in tune with nature. And we disregard it, but some of the saints and sages of India that really study this stuff, they not only say that it's true, but we get back in that point in time again, which will be the next Treta Yuga, roughly 4100 AD, that then telepathy and clairvoyance will once again become a knowledge. And so you can then understand why you don't have writing, and then it sort of it comes into being, and why you might get to a point where you really don't need it again, where it's rather redundant.
I see. Because the race of man gets to the point where misunderstanding or record-keeping or communication is so increased just by pure telepathic communication, we don't really need a highly developed written language.
Yeah, and it's so hard to understand the future or higher states of consciousness. Think of a farmer in the 18th, 19th century, and if we could go back there to him right now and describe the future, and we could say, hey, we have robots that are on Mars roaming around doing scientific experiments. We have little devices we carry around in our pockets so we can instantly talk to somebody in China. And, oh, we can clone farm animals and plants and stuff. And the guy would probably say, you know, what are robots? How did they get to Mars? What is roaming around there? You know, because this is before engines or anything like that. And why do you carry these devices? And do you speak Chinese? Do they need know something we need to know? Or cloning would just scare him. And that's only 100, 150 years. So how on earth are we going to understand, you know, something 1,000 years more advanced than us, or 2,000 years? And that's what it's like when we're trying to understand these very ancient cultures. It's just inconceivable trying to relate to them.
I get that feeling as well, especially when somebody, quote, non-affiliated, makes a great discovery, like a new pyramid is found, or a new tomb, or an ancient mechanical device. The community, the affiliated community, instantly goes up in arms and says, that must be a fake, because we know everybody ate hand-padded corn cakes and existed just barely with the use of fire back in those ages.
Yeah, the current sort of history theory is that mankind evolved out of Africa. People were hunter-gatherers until about 5,000 years ago. Tribes first banded together for protection from other warring parties. And written communication must precede any large engineered structures or populous civilizations. And the problem with that is we're now finding lots of engineered structures and populous civilizations before writing. We're finding devices like the Antikythera device, supposedly geared devices, weren't developed until the great clock-making era, 1300, and they're showing up in the BC era. Or batteries, you know, we're taught in the textbooks that Volta invented the battery in 1700. Well, gee, that's until we found the Baghdad battery and the Babylon battery. And, you know, even pyramids, you mentioned, we were taught that those are things that came from one of the first civilizations in Egypt. And now they've found this wonderful site in Caral, Peru, where they not only have pyramids, but they're contemporary with the Egyptian pyramids. And it's a civilization before any writing. So, you know, how does it give you time to get over from the Eastern Hemisphere to the Western Hemisphere and evolve and build something? So history's theory is really being thrown on its head right now, although they don't talk about it too much in the mainstream community until, you know, some logical answers come to the fore.
Well, one of the things that still is very sharp in the mainstream community is Occam's razor. So when you're talking about two civilizations that live on opposite sides of the planet, one lives with fairly good water access and only a couple hundred miles, almost at the same altitude or at least level of ground for quarrying rock. And the other, on the other side of the planet, the quarry is, sure, it's only 40 or 50 miles away, but it's 9,000 feet in altitude difference. And you're talking very, very similar construction. It leads one to believe that either they had a common origin, that is to say, the people who built the pyramids in Egypt went to Peru and built pyramids, or they had a common teacher. Someone stopped by and said, this is the kind of structure you need to build in order to tap into the energy of the cosmos or in the energy of the world, or leave us a marker so that we can come back at a future time. Who knows why they were built, but the fact that they were built by different engineers on different sides of the world in an extremely ancient time, Occam's razor says that the most logical conclusion at the end of the day, after everything's carved away, makes sense. So it would make sense that they either were the same builders or they had the same teachers. Does it not?
Yes, I would agree. Or that consciousness is just at that level, you know. So they can build really interesting, complex bridges in China, and so can we build them over here right now. But we really think nothing of it, that they need to have the exact same plans or that they're the same people, simply because we know how to do this. We know how to engineer things. It's just a straightforward thing to do. And likewise, back then, you know, they could have been civilizations that communicated with each other if they wanted, or not. But it was just something that they built. The more interesting question to me is, why are they building pyramidal structures? And why are they building so many round hinges, you know, the whole megalithic culture?
These
are types of buildings that, you know, are more difficult to build than squares.
Well,
we're
still at a loss, because you mentioned that, you know, we could build these complex structures today. Well, maybe not. I mean, if you're going to order an 80-ton black granite block or a series of them that have to be raised 60 feet to 120 feet up in the air, put into place, and by the way, they have to fit so well that we can't fit a piece of paper between them. And the remarkable thing is that the measuring system that was used in, say, Giza was probably different than the measuring system that was used in the Sudan, where the granite was quarried. We have the same problem today. We try to use millimeters or microns or inches or thousandths of an inch, and yet we still have tolerances that show up and things that are out of tolerance and won't fit. That didn't happen back then. You don't see any scrap black granite blocks laying beside the Giza pyramid that didn't fit.
Yeah, I'm not sure the scrap situation, but we do have those mistakes today, you know, that we work in yards and meters, and on a mission to Mars not long ago, the two became confused and the aircraft had crashed. You know,
yeah, Beagle 2 splatted into Mars at about Mach 7.
Yeah. Hey, it might be helpful to maybe back up a little bit here and just sort of give a premise for, you know, if the ancients are right, if there really are more advanced cultures in the distant past, how does that work? You know, why does consciousness change over time? So is now a good time to do that?
Well, I wanted to, you know, in our third hour is where we'll tie all this together. And one of the remarkable things about the fact that our solar system is going through space at 18.5 miles per second, and we're drawing this amazing circle with the axis of our planet through the 12 constellations, is the fact that inside the heliosphere, things are pretty constant. In other words, it keeps showing up on the same date, but outside the heliosphere is where this amazing zodiacal change is taking place. What kind of forces are working on our solar system to make it move and make it draw this precession?
Clearly the solar system moves. And just to put this idea in sort of a simple perspective, the Earth spins on its axis. That gives us this cycle of day and night. The Earth goes around the sun, and that gives us, you know, the seasons. And then the ancients said that as this greater cycle takes place, this precession of the equinox, consciousness itself will rise and fall over very long periods of time. And the modern theory of precession, of course, would be that it's simply the oblate Earth wobbled by the forces of the sun and the moon acting upon it.
Right.
The Earth sort of fat at the middle. But the problem with that is that if that's true, then the Earth would be changing orientation to objects within the solar system, say relative to Venus or Mars or the Moon, that sort of thing. And yet we find very little precession relative to objects of the Earth, relative to objects within the solar system. We only see this change relative to objects outside the solar system. And as you mentioned, the ancients measured it relative to points on the zodiac. The only way...
One of the things in our solar system that shows up every August 12th is a meteor shower, right?
Yeah.
How long has that been happening on August 12th?
Well, I think it's a pretty long time. That happens to be my birthday, so that's one thing we've studied here, that the Perseids shower you're referring to, we think is one indication that the Earth doesn't wobble relative to objects within the solar system, that this phenomenon known as precession must really be due to the whole motion of the solar system through space. And that's what causes these stars to appear to move just slightly over very long periods of time. And so when you have a reason like that, Brooks, for then you have a mechanism for the potential rise and fall in consciousness. And
Exactly.
And that's key to understanding this whole idea of why you might have more advanced things in the very ancient past, why almost all the civilizations prior to the Dark Ages seem to be going downhill, whether it's the Indus Valley, Sumer, Akkad, Mesopotamia, even the Roman culture is far more brutal than the Greeks, who gave us democracy. And, you know, by that time, the Earth is just becoming a very brutal place. Same thing in China, that with the Han Dynasty taking over. And then we kind of wallow through the Dark Ages before we have the Renaissance, the rebirth, and sort of we're moving back up again now. And again, I think the only way to logically explain some of this is to take seriously this ancient idea that the cycle might be real.
Yeah, exactly. And like I said, Earth Explorers, in the third hour, we're going to tie consciousness together with the region of space where our solar system travels on a regular basis, and perhaps with, and we're beginning to discuss it more in depth now, the other forces, the other bodies that may be out there that we don't really see, we don't really talk about. But Walter, in his book, Lost Star of Myth and Time, discusses the possibility that our sun is actually part of a binary star system. That is to say, when we look out at space, we see neutron stars coalescing around each other. We see stars that are in orbit around each other. But we don't really think too much about the planets that are in orbit around those stars that are also traveling around those as those stars revolve around each other. So let's talk about that for about 10 minutes.
Okay, well, that's my main company, Brooks, is this Binary Research Institute, and that's where we do a lot of this study. And again, this all ties into this ancient idea of this rising and falling ages. You know, why are there rising and falling ages? And I think it's explained clearest by Sri Yukteswar. He was a Sanskrit scholar and quite a sage. And he said that this precession phenomena is not only due to the solar system's motion around another star, but that as we go through that process, get closer and to and then farther from another point of light, then there's a waxing and waning effect that occurs here. There's, all stars are massive generators of electromagnetism. And so, and that's what, that's what light is. When we see the light from the sun, we just see the visible light, but it includes this whole electromagnetic spectrum that runs from X-rays to gamma rays and infrared to ultraviolet. But it's this waxing and waning effect that the ancients would tell us affects consciousness. And when he wrote this, the idea that stars might be in pairs, gravitationally bound to each other, it was very, very rare. It wasn't a really well-known thought, and was thought to be, you know, something that doesn't happen often. And nowadays, most astronomers will tell you that at least 50% of all stars are in binary or multiple star relationships. And the NASA Chandra website actually says it's close to 80% of all stars are in these gravitational pairs, and sometimes it's three or four or more. And so, you know, it now becomes not rare, but commonplace to expect that our sun, too, might have a partner. And that takes us, of course, into a whole other field of what kind of star can it be and how can we find it and all that sort of thing.
Well, besides that, and I don't know if we have enough time to go into all that detail, but the fact that stars come in pairs, that's the norm rather than the exception, so it leads us clear logic to say that our sun also has a star magnetic brother or sister out there around which they're revolving around each other, sort of like balls at the end of a string spinning in space. But the planets going around those stars are also revolving around each other. So now what we have is we've got an elliptic, right? We have a cycle besides the one around, we go around our sun every 365 and a quarter days. There's another orbit that we have to worry about or consider now, right?
Well, yeah, we go around our sun, and basically this is Kepler's laws. All planets move in ellipses. You know, even the Earth going around the sun, it's not an exact circle. We have a period of time where we're going a little faster when we're closer to the sun, close to 91 million miles, and then a period of time when we're going a little slower, and our farthest point from the sun is 95 million miles. So you can see it's not an exact circle there. But likewise, if we're in a binary orbit, it would have the same sort of elliptical fashion, elliptical nature to it, where there'd be a period of time where things are waxing and a period of time where things are waning. And so that is sort of what the ancients talk about, that when we're in this waxing period of time, when we're getting effectively more light, we're getting closer to a certain point in space that has a positive effect on us, that we're then moving up from the darkest ages to the through the iron, bronze, silver, and golden age. And when we're leaving that point closest to this sweet influence, that's a name for it in the book of Job, then we're, you know, things are sort of going downhill here on Earth. And so
do you think that that sweet influence is this other star as our star goes in elliptical orbit around it?
I think it's actually a little bit more complex than that, in that it's not just the other star. I think it's
right.
We go around the other star, and that motion carries us closer to and farther from a third point in space. Which itself may be a star, may be something we don't know yet, but that's sort of what's hinted at in, by some of these Indian scholars. And
well,
so, yeah, they would call it Vishnu Nabhi.
The Indian scholars, is that that goes back to what, the Rig Veda, which talks about this heliocentric theory?
There are references to a heliocentric system, meaning Earth goes around Sun, in old ancient India, but they're kind of vague. But we also find them in very ancient Greece, too. Aristarchus of Samos talked about a heliocentric system. And even Archimedes, it's mentioned in some of his writings. But and this is about 500 B.C. or so, which is 2,000 years before Copernicus supposedly invented discovered the heliocentric system. And what that was really was a rediscovery of a knowledge that had been lost from long, long, long ago.
We're still trying to figure that one out. I mean, Copernicus's discovery with his little telescope, trying to get the church to look through it, that is to say the government to look through it and realize that everything didn't revolve around the earth, it wasn't received too well. But I suppose that the ancient studies, were received very well and were part of their culture, right?
That's what all the evidence indicates. And, you know, on Copernicus, it's a very interesting story. He actually had five books in his possession. Three of them were ancient books, and one of them apparently had this information from either Aristarchus of Samos or Archimedes. And this is talked about in a modern book called The Book That Nobody Read, referring to De Revolute Onibus, Copernicus's book. And yes, Copernicus was very sort of hesitant to put this forth, and he wrote sort of an apologetic preamble when he sent it off to the Pope there, essentially on his deathbed. And it took, you know, several hundred years before it was accepted, and, you know, even Bruno was burned at the stake for believing that Galileo was under house arrest for talking about it. But it finally came about, you know, and that's the system we know exists today. But yeah, it was interesting that Copernicus himself got it from the ancients.
That's interesting. And then he knew where to look and what to look for. And when he looked through his telescope, he probably said, "Oh my gosh, they're right."
Yeah, I'm not sure how many direct observations he actually made, but he did enough study to put together a good logical case, that's for sure.
That is so interesting. My guest is Walter Crittenden. He has two websites. One is, I believe it's LostStarBook.com. And the other one is BinaryResearchInstitute.org. So if you want to, during this 3-minute break, catch up a little bit and make your phone calls, we will open the phone lines in our second hour and third hour, and you can call and ask Walter questions about it, especially if you've read his book. If you haven't, it's about time you picked it up, because you're going to come up to speed. We'll take about a 3-minute musical break, let you get a glass of water, and we'll be back. So don't go away. We'll be back with more with Walter Crittenden after this brief interlude. Thank you. Radio. We're coming to you live from Western Idaho. My guest tonight is Walter Cruttenden, author of Lost Star, Myth and Time. And we're so glad you're here with us tonight. We've had a little bit of a challenge with the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition. The problem was our boat was too small. Only 100 seats. We had well over 2,000 applicants. So we went back to the charter and asked him to find a bigger boat. So we're on the verge of moving from a 100-seat craft to a 500-seat craft. That's going to make a big difference and make it available to a lot more people instead of a very, very pricey per-seat cost. It is now going to be well within the range of just about everybody listening to this program. We'll keep you posted. If you haven't signed up for the newsletter, please sign up for it. We'll be sending out a notice to you, and you'll be able to participate in that expedition in a very big way and be a part of history. Walter, welcome back to the program.
Hey there, Brett.
All right. In our last hour, we laid out the idea that precession is a very real cosmological cycle through which we're going and about which the ancients had a lot of detailed information that, given the fact that they were all ostensibly hunter-gatherers, they shouldn't have had. And something amazing happens in this cycle, and we're wondering at the last of the hour why the cycle happens, and the realization that our star may be part of a binary star system. That is to say, our solar system is in orbit around another solar system. And that draws us into a very interesting region of energy. Let's talk a little bit this hour about that energy and what effect it seems to have in a cyclic way upon the human race.
Okay, well, just a quick correction. If our star, our sun, is going around another star, it doesn't mean that other star necessarily has a solar system, although clearly the planet hunters out there are finding that there are more and more planets out there than they ever originally imagined. But anyway, I think your question is, so how does this mechanism work? How would our getting closer to or farther from another star actually affect consciousness? And to understand that, you need to understand, how does the sun affect life here on Earth? So when the Earth spins on its axis and we face the sun, we get the full brunt of the electromagnetic effect, the electromagnetic spectrum, and our bodies are attuned to that, and so, you know, we all wake, we become active, photosynthesis occurs, we actually go from subconscious, where we were at night, to a conscious state during the day. And then, of course, when we turn back around to the night side again, 99% of all life is pretty well adapted that, okay, it's going to go into a subconscious state again. So we have a change from conscious to subconscious just due to that diurnal motion of the Earth. Secondly, as the Earth is moving around the sun, think of what a dramatic effect that happens. At that point when the Earth starts to get more electromagnetism, you know, the electromagnetic spectrum of the sun, let's just call it light, per square inch, spring occurs, and things come out of hibernation, billions of creatures spawn or start to migrate, literally plants just pop out of the ground, and this whole cycle begins. Trillions of plant forms are affected, and then when that light waxes, you know, things decay, they go into dormancy, animals hibernate, migrate again, all sorts of things occur, again, just due to that second motion of the Earth and the waxing and waning light. So if indeed there is a third motion that also has a waxing and waning influence, then you can expect that it too is going to have a pretty dramatic effect on life over a long period of time.
Sure.
But people would say, hey, I can understand why the sun would affect you, because that's pretty close. But how could really another star affect us? Because they're so far away. And it was thought, Brooks, just until 10 years ago or so, that other stars really didn't have any effect on us here. And that was about the time that somebody happened to notice, I think it was actually, there was a nurse driving home from a Seattle hospital, and her radio station on her car, it flipped to another station in North Dakota or something. And at the same time, ham radio operators were put off the air, and some of the satellites went into shielding mode. And somebody realized that, oh, this is all occurring at night, so it's not due to a solar flare, an X-class flare. And so it was just 10 years ago that people figured out there are bursts that come from other stars now and then, and they're affecting life here on Earth in very real ways. And so those things have been sort of studied a little bit more, and we understand that there are gamma ray bursts from other stars. But it sort of opens the door, opens the window to the idea that, hey, we can be affected by other stars to some degree. And that would be to a high degree if we're actually orbiting one.
Well, it's kind of interesting, and maybe I want to lay a few facts in here and see if we can't switch some lights on. When radiation covers the Earth, when it comes from other stars as pulses, or it doesn't seem to line up with our own solar activity, this energy normally arrives in the form of photons, waves, or particles. And it's commonly known, in physics anyway, that photons are information of some kind. The frequency that they carry is specific to a certain event. We use it all the time for spectroscopy. It's how we know when there's iron in something, or arsenic, or titanium. It's because of the frequency of the photon that is given off, thus the absorption, when we irradiate that element with energy. Now, we think of this in purely scientific terms, but now Walter is really making it available for us to understand that our DNA, the molecules and matter that make up our bodies, our genes, our brains, has a lot of latent stuff, some stuff that's in hibernation, so to speak. And these photons coming from this other star have informational effects on that on a molecular level. And so not only do the grasses and the flowers spring forth in spring, but maybe our consciousness springs forth when we come around on our cycle with this other star. Is that what you're trying to say?
Yeah, and there are some analogies there. When astronauts go into space and they're separated from the sort of the electromagnetic cocoon of the Earth, they feel really bad, really depressed, and so they do things to offset that, like, you know, put negative ion generators in spacecraft now. Or we've all heard of people that have SAD disease, this seasonal disorder, where some of the population is very, very acutely affected by the diminishment of light. And so I don't know that it's specifically affecting their DNA, but it is having an effect. And one of the neat experiments done along this line was conducted by Dr. Valerie Hunt at UCLA. She was a physiologist there. And what she did was she took a number of people and put them into a mu room at the physics lab of UCLA there, and it's actually a Faraday cage. And those technologists out there will know a Faraday cage is sort of a insulated room, so you could make sensitive electronic circuits in it and not have to worry about microwave interference, that sort of thing. But she was doing this physiology experiment. She wanted to see how people reacted when they're sort of completely separated from the electromagnetic soup that we all live in all the time. And what happened was people put in there, she gave them tests to do. Not only did they perform poorly on the tests, but they kind of grew agitated, sad, and some of them even sobbed, and they didn't know why they were crying. And it's because we need something that's very subtle, that's in our environment, our sort of our electromagnetic environment, if you will. And so she even did an experiment where she reversed it, where people could get the full effect plus negative ions. These are naturally generated around waterfalls and seashores and things like this. And people performed better on the tests and just felt a little bit more elated. So we think that this is kind of what's going on a very long-term basis, that as the solar system moves through space, the sun around another star, it carries the Earth with it, of course, and the Earth is slowly subjected, and it changes our ionosphere, magnetosphere, and consciousness itself over long periods of time.
So as this consciousness changes, and it makes complete sense because now we have empirical or experimental data proving that the lack of Earth vibrations, and I believe it's something like 7.8 hertz that seems to synchronize with the biosystems of the human body. Once we're without it, we feel completely disoriented, and that may take some getting used to, or maybe it's just not possible for human beings without that bio generator in the spacecraft or in long voyages into space to get along or have emotional stability. But the fact that we are affected by that means, or at least it lends credulity to the idea that if we got close to another vibration, one that awakens latent things in our DNA, in our genetic structure, that has been asleep for thousands of years, and now the human race is being bathed by it again, albeit very slowly now, and as we get closer and closer to the crescendo of this, the age that we just entered, what was it, 1969 we entered this age, or 1968, the increase of that, the amplitude of that vibration, of that frequency, is going to increase. And consciousness, human consciousness of the race, is going to change. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I think it is changing. Although on the dates, I think it is the Indian thinking is correct here in that they put the low point at 500 AD. That's the point when our star is farthest from this other star, farthest from this third point in space. And it fits with the historical record. You see that by that time, virtually every great ancient civilization has fallen. Even Rome is crumbling. The Han Dynasty is brutal in Japan. They're crucifying people in the streets in Europe. It's not much better over in Mesoamerica, where many of the cultures there have fallen, The Maya culture is close to human sacrifice. I don't know which is better, crucifixion or human sacrifice. But the Earth got to a very low point, and it stayed there for a while, with torture being a fine art, and virtually every nation at war with one another 500 years ago. And then we slowly crept out of it, and the Sanskrit scholar Swami Sri Yukteswar would put the changing point from sort of the lowest age, the Kali Yuga, into this next age, the Dwapara Yuga, or in Greek terms, going from iron to bronze, at about 1700 AD. So it fits very closely with the Renaissance, and it's a smooth transition, just as like going from winter to spring is doesn't all happen all at once on March 21st. It's a transition. And so, yes, things are on the upswing now. Consciousness seems to be expanding. Some of the old institutions are, have to sort of fall apart for new institutions and new and better ways of doing things so that they can replace the old ways.
Why do you think there's almost a global feeling, almost a universal feeling, that the human race has been to this crescendo of technology and transportation and communication before, and we didn't make it? And this time we're being brought to this precipice one more time, and maybe with the right consciousness, maybe we can make it through it. Why do we have that feeling?
Well, we probably have been through it a lot more, if some of these saints and sages are right, that, it's happened over and over and over again, hundreds of times. But, the material side is the lowest age. If you look at these Greek descriptions of the ages, the lowest age being the iron, is they call it the age of man. And the Indians would say that's a time when man can only perceive, thinks, what is real is what he can perceive with the senses. He has no knowledge of finer forces, electricities, magnetism, molecules, atoms, none of that stuff. And then the next age up is the age of the hero, the Bronze Age, the Dwapara Yuga. And that's the age we're getting in now, and God knows there's plenty of chances to be heroic, because we're the material age is slowly losing its grip, and we're coming into a higher way of thinking. And then the ages after that, again, they're inconceivable, but the Greeks would call them the age of the demigods. That would be the Silver Age, and finally the age of the gods, which is probably inconceivable to us right now.
Yeah, I would say it's inconceivable, but given the, well, at least the submission that possibly spirits of mankind do reincarnate from age to age, maybe somewhere in the back of our ancient memory, we have a memory of a golden age, and maybe we can bring a little bit of that to pass or to reality in this, the beginning of, the Dwapara Yuga is the Bronze Age, or is that what you're saying?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, I think we do have a memory. You're right on, Brooks. I got a beautiful email from a lady. She's a school teacher, and she had seen our documentary film on this subject. It's called The Great Year, narrated by James Earl Jones.
Right.
And it talks about this whole Great Year cycle and how it occurs. And about halfway through, she found herself crying. And she couldn't figure out why she was crying. And then she realized, as a little girl, she had believed in a great year, in this cycle, that there really were more advanced ancient cultures. She believed in a golden age, and yet she was taught in school that, this is just a fairy tale, forget that, life's just linear. And when she realized that there was good evidence for a long-lost golden age, she just had a cathartic experience, and she just let loose. And I really believe that that's what society needs now. You know, we're thinking that we're at the pinnacle of mankind, and we have all these problems. We're still just barely out of the dark ages, and we could really, really learn from the ancients if we were wise.
Well, if what she feels is true, and what many people perhaps might be a little difficult to admit, if that's true, then maybe we are the ancients. And all we really have to do is draw that memory, some glimpse of it, some capsule of it, forward with us here. And maybe, because we definitely have the wherewithal to do it, we have global wealth and capabilities that perhaps have never existed on the planet before, and we have the ability to communicate instantaneously, as we're doing tonight, with X Squared Radio. And by the way, don't forget, the Earth Explorers, the phone lines are open. So if you want to call in, that phone number is 776-530-5154. Anywhere on the planet or off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can get to us and perhaps share a little bit of your memories with us. So what do you think about that? That maybe we are the ancients, and all we really have to do is just wake up.
Well, I'm sure there's some truth to that. Philosophically, I would tend to agree with you. That's a very common belief in the East that we do reincarnate over and over again. So you got to think that most of us, if that's true, have some intuitive belief in this idea, and I think it's true.
You know, there are a couple of amazing things I can think of in nature. One is, of course, the bear, who, when it gets cold and the days get short, he crawls into his cave, lowers his heartbeat. He doesn't die. He's just not conscious that he's conscious. And then springtime comes and the days get longer again, and he pops out and continues on with his marvelous natural existence. And the other is the caterpillar, who for some crazy reason crawls around and eats leaves, and then one day goes to sleep, wakes up, and the next thing he knows, he's leaping off of the leaf and flying through the air. Does the caterpillar have the memory of being a butterfly? Does the butterfly have a memory of being a caterpillar? Who knows? But if you search your soul down there in the quiet part during meditation, or you watch the film The Great Year, something in there resonates with truth. And I've seen a lot of quote-unquote religious people make a mighty awakening in their lives when they're confronted with something like this possibility. It's as though the lights turn on and they go, oh yeah, that's why I have this feeling.
That's a common theme too in myth and folklore. You know, this fellow I mentioned earlier, Giorgio De Santayana, the former professor of history of science at MIT, and his co-author, Hertha von Deschen, She had held a similar post at Goethe University in Frankfurt. They wrote this amazing book, Hamlet's Mill, where they essentially find that myth and folklore are not just the gibberish of primitive people. It's a scientific language of yore. And so looking from that perspective, they were rereading many of these myths, and they find that one of the most common, and really one of the oldest of the Greek myths, it goes back to about 700 BC, is this myth of invariance. And it's the problem of the one and the many. You know, how did the one become the many, and how do the many get back to being the one? And it's sort of a principle behind a lot of these myths and cosmology. And, you know, you have all these heroes that are, and these craftsmen god that are, they're reflections of God, so to speak, in these myths, because God, you know, wants to create, so he needs to make a copy of himself so he can be in a physical universe. And then these craftsmen gods are go through this hero's journey to kind of get back to realize that they're the one. And our cosmology today is really no different. If you think about it, you know, we've got the Hadron Collider over in Switzerland, where we're trying to split an atom to its very essence. We're looking, where did everything come from? Where did the many come from the one? Or we talk about the Big Bang as a theory. You know, we're trying to find out where everything came from. When did it all come from one? And this is just this ancient form of thought that we're all here. We're all the reflections of God, if you will, trying to get back to the one.
I like that idea. No real separation. Walter, we have a caller on the line. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from.
My name is Robin, and I'm calling from North Carolina.
I'm sorry, I had a hard time hearing that. Can you say that one more time?
My name is Robin, and I'm calling from North Carolina.
Well, welcome to the program, Robin.
Okay, I've got a couple questions for Walter, if you don't mind. Walter, can you hear me?
I sure can, Robin.
Okay, great. One is for you, Dr. Agnew. You might want to give some of your other numbers, like 530-413-4511, because the number you're giving is busy all the time. So I went to the number that was 776-5154. That's how I got through to you. So you might want to suggest to your callers try to get through to use. I know you have four other numbers that they can call, they can get through to you on. Walter, I am so excited to talk to you. My brother, who listens, apparently you have a radio program of your own. Is that true?
Yes, we interview all these historians and scientists on this topic. We're trying to sort of put together the whole puzzle. It's called The Cosmic Influence. It's on Apple iTunes.
Okay, he listens to you, and he's found you, and he's just absolutely, I mean, he's very fascinated because he's been just kind of starting on looking at some of this stuff, and he's got a very, he's a chemist, and he's got a very curious mind, and he's listened to you and has heard you guys say on your program, has gotten extremely excited about it because he, like you, finds that in many ways this makes a lot of sense based on you know, his work that he does. He actually sees some of this through chemistry, but I won't go into that. What I did want to ask you about was, you know, people have their own kind of an innate conscious awareness that, you know, of things around them, the telepathy, some people call it intuition, some people, you know, will say that they are telepathic, EST. I think people can focus, and I understand there are people out there who, if they focus that, they work with it, they actually can get better at it and are more acute. And do you think that people, I know that you're saying that this procession towards this golden age, we will kind of inherently benefit from that because the energies around us will be more conducive to expanding the consciousness within a human biology. But do you think, here we are, unfortunately we don't have another 2,000 years to wait, you know, until 4100. So in the meantime, for those of us who are trying to get in touch, I know exactly where you're going,
Robin. Right.
Okay,
let me just say that, you know, we're all affected by our environment and geography. And so, yes, it's easier to see during the day, but it doesn't mean we have to stumble around in the dark at night. We can invent lights and candles and other mechanisms. And likewise, during the year, it's easier to stay warm and have food in the summer than it is during the winter. But if we're clever, we can think of ways to store up food and stay warm in the winter. Likewise, during the great year, while there might be a season that's much more beneficial to bring out the very best in us, it doesn't mean we have to wallow around in a dark age consciousness. We can do all sorts of things. You know, we can eat right. We can exercise properly. We can practice meditation. And there's a whole number of techniques. And people that really live in tune with, you know, their higher nature do manifest these wonderful skills, as you mentioned. And while saints and sages might not be very prevalent at this particular time on Earth, there are some, and I think we'll be seeing more and more as we progress into the higher ages, and people just become more aware of speeding up their own evolution.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. So if you do these practices, and like you said, the meditation, focusing, there's, you know, different schools on teaching people how to focus their intentions, how to draw in the energy that is out there and actually make the body more conducive to doing that. What you're saying here, then, ultimately, is if we were to rather than it just being showered on us with very little effort, it would just be there, let's say 2,000 years from now, if we do focus these things, if we do we could develop a consciousness that is very much like one that, through working through it, we could develop it rather than waiting for it to happen.
Right on. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I know some monks that I hang out with now and then, and they do these wonderful deep meditation practices all the time, and they're just tremendously intuitive and successful. But most people just don't seem to want to make the effort in the present day and age, and certainly the mass media doesn't seem to encourage it. They seem to focus more on the problem. And so it'll just be a little bit easier in the higher ages, probably a lot easier. But you always have a color of people. You know, there'll be a few enlightened people in the lowest ages, but there'll be a lot of them in the higher ages. But great question.
Well, this is really exciting. So you're talking about people actually being able to now, would be able to tap into that where they could self-heal. If they knew how to do it, they could, a lot of things that are right at their fingertips right now, if they take the time, it actually could improve their life 200-fold.
Yeah.
In many ways, in respects.
Yeah, read this book called Autobiography of a Yogi by Paramahansa Yogananda. He has many wonderful chapters in there about all these saints he goes and meets with. And, yeah, there's a lot of charlatans and fakes out there, but there's some very real saints and sages, too. And it's a fascinating account. Again, it's Autobiography of a Yogi by Paramahansa Yogananda.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Say hi to your brother.
I will. Say hi to Bill. Actually, if you could say Bill Hancock, your sister called on another show. I just want you to know she let us know that how interested you are in the program and wanted you to say send out a hello to you for her. I'd really appreciate it. He'd get a kick out of it.
Okay, I'll try to remember that. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye bye.
Well, I like the idea that, obviously when the sun comes up, we can see clearly and we don't have any problem walking around obstacles. And at night, it makes sense to turn a light on. And what I have noticed, if I may make an analogy here, is that some people are turning on a laser pointer while other people are turning on a searchlight. There's a big difference in how you move about in this time of increased, shall I say, a consciousness soup. And unfortunately, and I really don't want to, put down anybody or any organization, but unfortunately we have prejudices. We have rationalities that are handed down to us, not only from our parents, but also from our religions that prevent us from turning the light on at night. Do you see that as well?
We do, and there's a wonderful book you've probably heard of called Guns, Germs, and Steel by the anthropologist Jared Diamond. He does this study of, why some civilizations and tribes on Earth succeed, whereas others have failed. And he says it has to do with environment and geography. And those that were in the great geography with the good environments that were able to develop steel and guns and, have the bad germs or at least, but not themselves get sick, far exceeded the abilities of those that didn't have those advantages. Well, likewise, as the whole solar system, the whole Earth gets into a better environment and in geography and space, there are points where, more and more people just start lighting up, if you will. I like your analogy, the laser versus the searchlight.
Well, I guess it boils down to, you can lead a horse to water, but if it's against his religion to drink the water, you can't make him drink. He's just going to stand there and die of thirst.
That's life. Yeah, that's too bad. But, we're all kind of going through these journeys. Again, I think looking for ourselves, getting back to the one. But it's we have free will. And I know I do some things, sometimes forget to exercise or eat something that I know isn't good for me, things like this. And we all have to make the supreme effort if we want to truly be free, truly be a light to the world.
Well, I guess sooner or later, you're going to have to walk out in the noonday sun and you're going to have to look up and say, wow, it's light outside. It's not dark. And maybe, year by year, season by season, as we see the planet around us change, you say our environment is one of the main effects. One of the environments that we pay little attention to is our own consciousness. Our consciousness creates an environment for the very DNA that make up our body. It affects our health. It affects our stamina, our creative ability, our ability to love, and our ability to weather the bad things that come to us. I guess, Walter, what you're alluding to is that the sun is coming up. Spring is beginning to spring for us. And maybe we shouldn't go through another day saying it's still winter or it's still dark.
No, I think we're on the waning or the waxing side here. More light is coming in, and it's often a time of turmoil when a bunch of people are waking up. heading for the water. But it's a positive time, and I think we can do things to foster that and help things along. I'm often asked about this whole 2012 phenomena and the Mayan culture, and you know, we study as much as we can about that and how that fits into this cycle. And there are other cycles. We've been talking mostly about the Great Year, but there's another cycle called the Saeculum, which is it's roughly 80 to 100 years. It's when everybody on the planet has died, so the last person to remember something no longer remembers it. You can bet that that group is about to experience something that they forgot about, because their behaviors are going to get them back into a situation like that. So it could be that, you know, we sort of have several cycles coming together, and this is you know, creating a real inflection point. But something seems to be happening, and I don't know, you know, whether anything specific happens on December 21st, 2012, but there does seem to be an awakening of consciousness going on at this time on the planet.
Well, one of the pieces of evidence that maybe adds to the case is the fact that our star might be in the orbit around another star, and that is leading us into a region of space that has a proximity to that star, and the energy, shall we call it, the radiation that comes from that star is in such a frequency and such an energy information, and that's what photons really are, that we as a race are beginning to change. So do you think that the radiation, the frequencies, the energy of this region of space has different qualities, and that those qualities can affect the matter and energy that make up a human being?
I do think that, yes, space has different energies for sure. You know, all these stars are massive generators of electromagnetic energy spectrums. I don't know, you know, how you tell exactly where you are in this, other than whether you're getting closer or whether you're getting farther. But sort of poetically, I can think of it kind of like we're moving towards spring, and you get to a certain point where you have a warm day and everything seems to be blooming at once. And so I'm wondering if the ancients weren't trying to call attention to that when they were talking about, you know, 2012 or something like that.
Well, it could be. I mean, we do see a message of doom and cataclysm and upheaval and seas leaving their bounds and all of that. But we also see, at least in most of the tomb evidence, like, you know, Pakal and Palenque and all that, that there's also this crossing of the nexus of the galaxy and a great awakening. I mean, can we somehow give some credit to this evolutionary effect we're going through right now?
Sure. Yeah, it's a combination of factors. So we get to a point where we're in a geography that favors the environment, and also there's enough people getting fed up with the way things have been that they want something better. And sometimes that's painful, you know, to kind of get rid of the past, to break down the old institutions.
Well, a lot of the institutions now were
actually formed in the Dark Ages, you know, something like the Catholic Church. You know, down deep there's a really beautiful message there, but a lot of the doesn't mean that all of the people working there have been living right, and that all the, you know, the crust that's sort of come on the top has a pure and perfect purpose.
Well,
you've got to break down the old ones.
There's certainly some greatness and some miracles to go there, but it's becoming clear, as spring is springing and the light is now dawning, that there have been some misconceptions as well. I think we have Mark on the phone from Ohio. Mark, you're on the program. How are you?
Real good, Dr. Agnew. How are you?
Doing great. Welcome.
Thank you. I have a couple questions for Walter. One is the Colburn Bible offers some descriptions of a large reddish object called the Destroyer. Have you studied that, or can you comment on some of these historical accounts?
I am not familiar with that. No, I'm sorry.
Huh, that's interesting. Also, have you read any of Zechariah Sitchin's work where he describes a massive object that orbits our sun every 3,600 years? I think the ancients called it Nibiru.
Yes, I've read some of his work, and I've spoken with a number of scholars about the meaning of Nibiru, and there's a few people have some differences on that, but I think that most of the really good scholars tend to believe that it's a word for a very bright object, and so the best thing that I've heard is that it probably refers to the star Sirius, and that could take us into a whole another 3-hour program because of the tremendous amount of myth and folklore about this particular star, which is the brightest star in the sky, and some of the strange phenomena about it. And so there's actually one theory that that might be the crossing star, the sun's companion, although there's some problems with that, the way some astronomy is now being interpreted.
Well, Walter, I do have a question about that. Does our alignment with Sirius change over time, or are we pretty much in the same location with respect to Sirius that we were, say, when the pyramid in Giza was built?
Well, let me just back up to address this right. So there's, if our sun is in a gravitational relationship with another star, like most stars are, then the question is, what star? And so there's sort of two schools of thought. If you believe everything about modern astrophysics, then any of the visible stars are too far away, and therefore it has to be a dark star of some type. But our instruments are getting good enough now to where if it was a brown dwarf or some planet-like mass, a size big enough to curve our solar system in 24,000 years, that we would probably know it by now. And so there's a whole other school of thought, which is really supported by some ancient thinking, and that is that it's a very visible star, and specifically Sirius. If we were in another solar system and we looked up and say, hey, that's our sun, and there's our companion star, we would point to the next brightest object. Sirius is the next brightest object for us today, but it's thought to be 8.6 light years away. But strangely enough, yeah, the coordinates, it seems to be the one star that doesn't possess. And I'm not making this up. There's some interesting stuff in the literature about this. A guy by the name of Buchwald at Caltech talks about it. There's a group of scientists up in Canada they've had a telescope fixed at Sirius for over 20 years now, and they show no precession of the Earth in relation to this particular star. And then to get to your point, Brooks, the Great Pyramid of Giza has these four shafts. One of them now points to Sirius. And why would they point a shaft to Sirius just in our lifetime? You know, Sirius is Isis, the all-important god to the ancient Egyptians. Or does this shaft always point there? Because you know, the mechanics of a binary star is it would sort of be the one star that doesn't precess, because the observable of precession is us going around that star causes all the other stars to appear to be moving at about 50 arcseconds per year. And this all gets back to Nibiru, because all the writings about Nibiru being a crossing star, I think Sitchin has misinterpreted to say, oh, that's crossing, must be crossing into our solar system. And I don't find any evidence for that, because if it happens regularly, you know, all the planets would be perturbed. There'd be a whole bunch of problems. But I do find evidence that it appears to be crossing against the other stars, not precessing while all other stars appear to precess.
Well, that would be interesting. What do you think, Mark?
That is something I hadn't thought about at all. I had another question that kind of goes off on another tangent. I wondered if Walter had ever heard of the IRAS satellite in 1983 discovered some kind of large object outside our solar system, and then there was really not much more talk about it after that. Have you heard about that at all? Or?
Yeah, the IRA, the infrared survey, there's been actually a number of them since to some degree. And because I work at the Binary Institute, I get all these emails from people seeing every conceivable object, and, you know, then we exchange a few emails on it, try to find out what's going on there in the literature. And so far, most of these things are explained away. Not to say that we're not finding new things. I mean, you know, we've found Xena, bigger than Pluto since then. Sedna, which has a orbit beautifully in sync with this 24,000-year orbit, by the way. It's actually a 12,000, so it's a 2-to-1 resonance. So they are finding things out there, they're not finding anything that actually comes within the solar system of any mass other than, of course, comets.
Well, if there were planets that were revolving around Sirius or Sirius A, which is actually the more dense white dwarf that we can't see that's next to Sirius, you know, it's possible that those planets, although not close enough to perturb any planets in our solar system, as they get on this side of that star and we get on that side of our star, maybe the planets get close enough to one another that if there is life there, the way Zachariah Sitchin alluded to, maybe they would make the travel. Maybe it would be close enough to make the jump, giving 8.5 light years.
Yeah, and you know, we think in terms of Dwaparan technology that we need a spaceship to do that, versus maybe that's not even the way, you know, interstellar travel takes place in higher ages. Who knows? I think the formula, as long as a planet that has another star, that it's in a binary relationship, if that other star is at least 5 times the distance of the distance of that planet to its home star, then there shouldn't be any perturbation. So you could get close without goofing the solar system up, but it can't go within the solar system.
Yep, exactly right. So what do you think, Mark? Does that answer your question?
One last question, and then I'll get off here. I wondered if Walter thought that maybe the South Pole Telescope was built to observe this second sun, and I'll take that answer off the air, and thanks a lot, guys. Bye-bye.
Oh, thanks for the call, Mark. You know, Sirius, at least for those of us in the Northern Hemisphere, at night is now, you know, below the horizon. It sets sometime in December, and it comes back up 77 days later in March. In fact, it's supposed to rise this month, and the Nile will, if the dams weren't in place, begin its seasonal flooding at the same time.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of myth and folklore about Sirius there, and I'm not sure we always interpret it right, but that's one of them, that when Sirius rises, it brings life with it. But I think it might also refer to the larger cycle, the great year. But that's another story. As far as Mark's question, I don't know what the telescopes in the southern hemisphere exactly are looking for. You know, there's a number of different telescopes down there, but as I study that, we'll be talking about that a little bit more on our program.
Well, that's cool. The people should know, especially those people that listen to this program a lot, most of the big telescopes, especially the ones that were placed with government grants, are fulfilling government contracts and are fulfilling requirements that they promised to do when they obtained that grant. So if you think for a moment that they're looking for near-Earth objects or they're looking for anything outside of the box, I would kind of drift away from that thought. I think most of the new discoveries, and by the way, last week we had an asteroid that we'd never seen before cross within 43 million miles of Earth, actually just a few hundred thousand kilometers. And that's pretty close. This thing was 36 meters across. So these kinds of things are being found by amateurs with good telescopes and a lot of patience, because there are thousands and thousands of these amateur telescopes looking at different areas of space. And they're gathering information. And I think, if there is a discovery that's going to come forth relative to, planetary activity around Sirius, it's probably going to come from an amateur. And we have another caller on the line. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from.
John from Massachusetts.
Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Brooks, and hi, Walter. I just have a quick question, and I'll take it off the air. I was wondering if you had any idea of any reference to the Bible when it talks about wormwood in reference to everything you're talking about.
Now, wormwood, is the destroying star that comes?
Yes.
I don't. Somebody wrote us about that a while back, and we never got around to looking at it. But the Bible's a great source of myth and folklore, and we've been studying more of that aspect of it related to the great year. I sure don't know everything about this subject. It's so huge, but that's a good question. I'll try to look into that a little bit more.
Emmanuel Velikovsky, John, wrote a book called Worlds in Collision. And in his day, he was excoriated for this book, but later was proven to be, spot on. He talked about great planetary and stellar interactions long ago that may fit the language in Revelations. And the interesting thing is, at least the way Emmanuel Velikovsky put it, that the descriptions that are in Revelations might be historical and not future-looking. Now, that's not to say they won't occur again, but the appearance of wormwood as it came close to Earth and its effects on Earth are well described in that book and really do fit what people would observe from an Earth's perspective, given stellar and interplanetary collisions out there in space. It's kind of interesting. You might want to pick up a copy and read it.
Yes, I will. That sounds very interesting.
Velikovsky, quite a character.
Okay. All right. Well, that's all I had, and I appreciate your show. You're great, great as usual.
Thanks so much, John.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. So we're nearing the top of the second hour, Walter. We'll go ahead and take a real short musical break. Normally we put commercials in here, but we've recently changed affiliates, and we're still preparing those commercials, so we just kind of give people a musical break a little bit, something to go get a moon pie and an RC and sit back down and enjoy the program. So if you'll let me do that, we'll take about a 4.5 minute break, and we'll be right back after this.
Or if I like what I've begun, but something told me to run, and honey, you know me, it's all going on. There were sounds in my head, a little voice is whispering that I should go and this should end.
Explorers, nice musical break. We appreciate your patience with us as we work our way through new systems, and you know, it's exciting having an internet talk radio program. We have listeners all over the world live, and then Monday morning, when thousands and thousands of people come into work and begin their work at their workstations, they load up the archives, put on their headphones, and listen to 3 hours of X Squared Radio during the week. And we appreciate you sitting there doing your work every day and listening to this program. Without you, we would not exist. And we've been here since 2005, and we greatly appreciate your presence. And that being said, we do want you to visit xsquaredradio.com and make sure to visit our affiliates, Vista Prints, if you've ever thought about having your own business, or you want people to know who you are, or what you do, what your favorite thing is to do, you need a business card, and there's no better price than free. That's right. If you click on the Vista Prints banner at X Squared Radio, you can pick up your business cards for free. And get your name out there. Make your mark. And if you like a little higher quality, like your own graphics or something like that, then you can get the more premium models. And trust me, they'll beat the prices of your local printer, and they'll do a fantastic job. And the shipping is almost instantaneous, almost like faxing your business cards to you. And also, if you have a student in college, as I do, those textbooks can get pretty expensive at the beginning of each semester. check out our other affiliate, Campus Book Rentals. Now, this is an idea that is right on the mark. You can actually rent textbooks for a semester of college. That's right. Just like renting a DVD, they are taking technology to the next level, Earth Explorers. It is possible now to rent those textbooks and save thousands of dollars on that college education. Check them out, Campus Book Rentals. And also, if you are in the Los Angeles area this coming weekend, don't forget to check out the 2012 Quantum Leap Conference. It is at the Marriott Hotel at the Burbank Airport. The roster of speakers there will astound you. Check it out. The link is on the right-hand side at xsquaredradio.com. You'll get a discount on the tickets. Amazing pricing available for Earth Explorers. Quite a discount. If you're looking for something to do this weekend, you need a nice positive shot in the arm, or you need a life change, this is the conference for you, the 2012 Quantum Leap Conference. It's put on by Sriram Kha and Kira, and you're going to really enjoy yourself. I am going to be there this weekend. George Nouri is going to be there, William Henry, and others. And trust me, this is going to be a positive message 2012 conference. No doom and gloom, folks. This is the place to come to get the lights turned on. My guest tonight is Walter Cruttendon. His book, Lost Star of Myth and Time. And his website is loststarbook.com and also binaryresearchinstitute.org. You might want to bookmark that one, especially people that are really interested in cosmology and astronomy. The latest research being compiled there and analysis and comment, a great website. And if you have a chance, go to Amazon, go to his website, and pick up the movie, the DVD, The Great Year. It's narrated by James Earl Jones, and you're really going to enjoy it. I have a copy of it. I've watched it twice. It's quite moving, and the animation and narration is phenomenal. Welcome back to the program, Walter.
Hey, Brooks.
Okay, this is the globally famous third hour of X Squared Radio. This is where we typically go beyond the imagination of the listener. However, they feel quite safe because they're with us. And although they often ride without seat belts on this program and look out the window, we will safely take them to the end of the universe and back tonight. Now, there are some things that we have laid groundwork for. We have talked about the fact that our sun is part of a binary system, another star, that star might be Sirius. In fact, it doesn't move much. We're looking at it with telescopes. It stays still. It's in the same place it was when the pyramids were built. Makes sense that we're orbiting right around that star. We've also talked about the idea that as our solar system passes into this region of space on a regular basis called the precession, that we are actually being exposed to different frequencies, and those frequencies contain information, and it seems to be having an effect on our consciousness, which is having an effect on our civilization. So where do we go with this, Walter? What do we leave people with tonight in the next 45 minutes that they can take home with them and begin this evolutionary process of awakening?
Well, that's a big question, but I think one of the first things it does for me when I kind of realize that, wow, the ancients might be right about all this, is that it gives us back our history or our place in time, if you will. Instead of perceiving ourselves as just, you know, just the first here ever sort of groping along, this idea that there is a great year, that there are these different epochs of consciousness over vast periods of time, can serve as sort of a template to figure out how to solve some of our present problems. And, you know, how did the ancients live, for example, much more in tune with nature? And And by understanding that, it's very freeing to realize that there is a cycle, and that it puts all this stuff in perspective. These findings we were talking about early, the anti-cathera device, the Babylon battery. You know, dentistry, I was reading about the other day, Brooks, that 200 years ago, if you had a bad tooth, you'd go to the dentist or the barber, really, and they'd give you some whiskey and they'd yank the thing out. That's here in the West. But if you go back 4,000 years, you find evidence of orthodontics in Egypt. And if you go back 8,000 years, they found some skulls in Pakistan, 13 skulls, with neatly drilled rear molars. This type of thing doesn't make sense in our current ideas and theories about history, but it does make sense when we understand that the Great Year is real, has a basis in fact. And so that's what this whole thing does for me, Brooke. It answers that original question I have of why did all these great old civilizations decline? And it gives us a real glimpse into the future. Where are we going from here? And there were just some beautiful, beautiful stories about it. Let me just mention one the Hopis talked about. I mentioned this in my book. According to the Hopi creation legend, the earth evolves through this progression of ages, which they called worlds. The Mayans called them suns. There's probably some relationship between those people. So the Hopi golden age is referred to as the first world or world of perfection, when all of life flourishes. And according to legend, there's Taiwa, the supreme creator of the earth, and he wanted a finishing touch, so human beings were created. And these people first experienced oneness with the earth and communed freely with their creator and one another without language, by thought, telepathically. And they could continue living in this paradise, Taiwa said, but only if they live in love and respect and creation. And unfortunately, as the legends of the other ancient cultures also relate, this time of perfection didn't last. The oneness they shared became divided, and everything became divided in the plan of the Creator. And so the Hopis have some sayings about this. Let me see if I can find this part. They say that we're now beginning to emerge from the fourth world of separation into the fifth world of illumination. Ultimately, the earth progresses to a sixth and seventh. Our journey takes us through a total of seven worlds or universes. This is referred to by Frank Waters in the book of the Hopi. And they write about, some of the legends talk about cities that are under the seas from long ago. So all these pieces that you start to learn about history, that we learn about discoveries in science, all begin to fall into place when you see that the Great Year really has some meat and some substance to it.
Well, it's interesting in your book, if I might quote this, you have a section called The Promise, and it says, most of us perceive ourselves as purely physical objects living in a strictly material universe, unaware of our quantum nature or potential. It's hard to believe in the existence of finer forces when the senses cannot directly perceive them. And then you say, indeed, higher age concepts are now entering the realm of discussion, and it is our physicists who are showing us the way. What did you mean by that?
Well, these references to higher age ways of life, when mankind is literally a demigod or a god, according to the Greeks, most people find a hard time believing. Even Christ says it in the Bible. He says, and he's quoting the Old Testament when he says, Is it not written that ye are gods? These things that I do, ye shall do also, and greater things. You know, we have a tough time believing that or seeing how it's even physically possible. Until you really start to take a close look at physics, and then we realize, well, what is everything? It's all just space and energy. You know, an atom has about as much mass as a fly inside Notre Dame Cathedral. There's
right.
just almost nothing to it. And yet it's our reality that we perceive right now, or where our consciousness is right now. It all seems very, very hard to us, all very material, and therefore very limiting. And supposedly in the higher ages, you know, it's not so limiting that we're capable of great and wonderful things. And I'm just wondering in that section of the book if the physicists aren't leading the way by the discoveries they're making today will be not just, you know, on the fringe of science. They'll be something that we can live by and figure out how to learn. When I read about some of these myths, people write me all the time about myths and ask me to reflect on it. And there was one somebody told me the other day. It's an old African myth, and it's about the henges, these stone circles. You know, we're all familiar with Avebury and Stonehenge, but few of us are aware of that there's 10,000 of these things all around the world. Anyway, there's this one in Africa, and the myth is that two people go to it, and someone goes inside it while the other person waits outside, and the person that went inside disappeared. And a little while later, they came back, and the person outside the henge said, "Where did you go?" And they said, "Not where, when. I went to a different time." And I like to speculate that if the Treta Yuga, the higher age, really has time annihilation devices, like some of the Hindus talk about, then how do we do that? What's the technology? And we recently interviewed a scientist, Ron Mallor, on our radio show, The Cosmic Influence. And he's a physicist at, I believe, University of Connecticut.
Oh, yeah, Ronald Mallory, right, the time machine guy.
Exactly. And the method that he's talking about, bending lasers, might be very well possible, or bending light, on a certain electromagnetic spectrum with henges. And here's how I get to that far-out stretch. And don't put me in jail right now, but at Avebury, the largest henge in the world, a friend of mine, John Burke, went there, and he took over 1,000 readings with a magnetometer, and it took him a little over a month. And you know how all stones have a natural polarity when they were formed by the Earth? The side that faced the North Pole is positive, and the side that faced South Pole is negative. So even though we can only easily tell with magnets, all stones have this ability on a very subtle level, and that's why it takes a magnetometer. Well, John went to Avebury, took these readings, and he found that all these stones, there's 66 of them remaining, are aligned by polarity. The positive side is always facing the next stone in line, and the negative side always facing away, as if they're lined up like dominoes. And so, put all this thought together. What if there's some subtle forces, some subtle energies that we haven't quite figured out yet, but the ancients did know about, and somehow, some reason, these henges are being used for something? You know, they're as prolific out there as bus stations. Maybe they really are some way to transport, to communicate. Who knows?
Wow.
So that's where this stuff leads me, Brookie. I just get out there with thinking about what the ancients might have known and what it might mean.
Well, you know, there are very aware, very capable teachers around the world right now. One that I can think of right off the bat is Jay-Z Knight, and her ability to channel a being she calls Ramtha. And she has a school she calls the Ramtha School of Enlightenment. And literally, you know, thousands and thousands of people have gone to this school and learn focusing techniques. They learn how to, for instance, put on what they call a mindfold. It's a blindfold that blocks out all light, let alone vision of where you're going. And yet these people can, thousands of them, can walk around a field and using nothing but mental focus find a card or a drawing that they made that's on a fence post around a corral that's about the size of a football field. Now that is really phenomenal. They shoot arrows at bullseyes 50 yards away with a mindfold on, and they hit it. These people are learning to develop techniques that have long since been lost.
I know that we have all this mythology about wizards and shaman and magic, and we think because we don't do this stuff, it must all be a bunch of baloney.
Right.
It's universal, you know, and maybe it's just because we haven't rediscovered it, just as it took us a while to learn rediscover the heliocentric system. We thought it wasn't real, and then we found it. Or electricity, and other things.
Well, that's interesting. So, as we near this realm of informational frequencies in the inside our own heliosphere, our heliosphere is, and this is the area of influence of our own sun. It extends beyond Pluto some ways. We near at this point of space, and we pick up this brand new, well, I should say brand new, this cycling information. Are you, at least in your Binary Research Institute, some of the data that you're collecting, are you seeing a global or a national or a racial awakening in the human race? Is this an energy that's pouring out over the whole earth, and some people know what to make of it and others do not, but the evidence of it is undeniable? Is that what you're seeing?
Well, personally, philosophically, that's something that seems obvious to me and that I embrace, although it's difficult to describe. Whereas at the Binary Research Institute, our work is pretty mundane, you know, as far as it relates to the heliosphere. For example, we're looking at new data. I don't know if you, did you catch this Voyager 2 data when it came in? I think it was about 18 months ago. Voyager 1, I think they both left in 1977, about a week apart. But one did a slingshot around Jupiter, and so it made it to the heliosheath, the edge of our solar system, much quicker than 2 did. And so it found the edge there was about 10 billion miles. And 2, and I'm just rounding, of course, and 2 was supposed to take several more years to get there. Well, it turns out that 2 hit the edge of the heliosphere at about 8 billion miles, and much sooner than expected. And whereas for present theory, that's a little puzzling, you know, because that says it's not a sphere at all, and it was a little bit unexpected, and they're coming up with ideas, well, maybe there's a gas cloud or something pressing against one side of our heliosphere. It's not at all a problem for this idea that our solar system is moving in that you would expect the heliosphere to be uneven. It's not a sphere at all. It's more of an oval or a bullet shape, a little shorter on you know, some sides than it is on the other, because we're moving at a high rate of speed. So that's really the type of research we're doing, Brooks. And I kind of take that research and then I put it together with my just readings on religion and mythology and so forth to better understand this whole idea of a great year.
Do you think, as some do, that this very unexpected change in shape of the heliosphere could be due to a solar wind from outside the heliosphere?
I don't know. I think I tend to go with the idea that we're just moving at a great rate of speed, and so it's being, we have kind of a bow wake, and it's being sheared off on one side, whereas it can be elongated around, you know, the back end, so to speak.
I understand. So as we go racing through the blackness of space around in a long orbit around Sirius, perhaps we're entering a region of space where space is more dense. Not saying that there's an ethereal substance to it, but maybe it's dark matter or dark energy that's creating some drag on the outer edges of our heliosphere.
Right, yeah. And you said around Sirius, I kind of take a little bit more of a neutral approach. There's a good case that could be made for that, but it's still to be found. And that's why we call it Lost Star. I don't know what star for sure it is. You'd have all these dynamics come into place, and there'd be telltale signs of that. You know, another one is the precession rate increases each year. There's no good reason for that under current lunisolar theory of precession. I mean, they have added in planets and asteroids and things like that to try to account for it. But it's been so smooth since Newcomb plotted it, you know, over 100 years ago. And yet it exactly fits what you would expect if we're accelerating, you know, again, in this elliptical orbit where you speed up and slow down. You'd have a precession rate that would be increasing, because precession in that model is simply the observable of the stars we see from a moving solar system. So if we're speeding up, the stars would appear to be going by a little faster. And that's exactly what's happening. The precession rate is increasing.
Well, that's what we were talking about in the first hour. You know, it's assumed, based on what things we've been able to exhume from the stone history books, that precession is made up of precisely equal segments of, around 21,000 or 2160 years. But that might not be the case. Some might be 2200, some might be 2000.
Yeah, if you divide 360 degrees by 50 arc seconds, then it takes you, you know, 25,920 years or something like that. And right now the precession rate is 50.29, roughly, up from 50.25 here not that long ago, 100 years ago. But to average 24,000 years, that'd be 54 arc seconds per year. So we think that, yeah, we're near the slow point of the orbit, so we're going closer to 50 arc seconds per year. At the fast point of the orbit, it'll look more like 58 arc seconds per year. And it just fits Kepler's laws very well.
Some might say, and by the way, Kepler was the author of elliptical theory, that planets don't go in a perfectly round, nice circular circle around another body. They tend to go in ellipses, which are more of an oval shape. And there again, most of the time, that body's not in the middle of that oval either. It's toward one side, so you kind of slingshot around the short radius and go a little slower around the long radius, right?
Exactly, right. Yeah, I think that's the third law.
Now, you know, there's a lot of lore, shall we say, out there. There's And we have a lot of listeners out there who pay very close attention to, say, an increase in earthquakes, an increase in volcanic activity, global warming, weather changes, sea chemistry changes. But they also pay attention to a difference in the frequency of appearances of other craft flying in the sky, besides the ones with N numbers on them or various national markings. I guess I'm talking about UFOs. Is there a relationship between this area, this region of space and higher consciousness, and the greater frequency of appearances of these off-world effects?
That's a good question. I don't know. I do know there's some, you know, ancient references in India to the flying patwas, so, you know, flying objects long, long before we developed airplanes or anything like that. You know, if there are all these planets out there that Jeff Marcy and the other planet hunters are finding, it's hard to imagine that you know, we're the only life form there, so I would think so. But I do think we tend to look at things sort of in early Dwaparan forms that, you know, if, like this whole SETI thing, you know, since we've developed radio waves and we think that's something that, you know, an advanced civilization has, that we ought to be looking for radio waves. And I bet they're so far beyond that that they... They chuckle that we would look for such a thing.
Oh, maybe they communicate with photons. Who knows?
Yeah.
One of the things
same
that
thing
found...
with the craft themselves, too. You know, maybe they're interdimensional or something. Who knows?
Yeah, they must fly on the wind like ours do. And by the way, they have to appear in the visible light range, which evidently a lot of them don't. They appear in other light ranges. One of the things
we
find,
going to some strange place where there's barbaric people, you know, they're familiar with the Yuga cycles. You know, first of all, how many of them really want to go visit a place where you're really low in the Yuga cycle? And if you do, are you going to put yourself out there to be seen? Highly unlikely.
Yeah, that's right. Because, you know, the way we treat our airspace above the United States is... it's sovereign, and if you don't belong there, you don't belong there, and they're going to get, you know, quite you know, cantankerous if you show up in our airspace unannounced, especially with anything large or in the way of anything we might be operating. On another note, what we find on the tomb of Pakal in Palenque, and we find a lot of evidence of this down in the Guatemala region, is the appearance of what's known as the serpent bar, and its direct relationship with the path of the Earth, or at least the Sun, through space, that it's not a linear straight line. It seems to be this kind of Ouroboros cycle, this eternal cycle with the serpent eating its own tail, which was a way, their way of looking at the Milky Way. But the serpent bar alluded to an elliptical orbit. Very interesting to find that in the ancient work.
Yeah. Some of this stuff, though, I'm sure, Brooks, you have to look at and think, is that the way we're interpreting it, or is that what they really meant? And the problem with, you know, so much of the Mesoamerican cultures, when the Spanish got there, the conquistadors, they just destroyed everything. And so virtually all the writings of the Maya were just demolished. Of the, what, there's four remaining codices. Of the one, it has the motions of Venus. So we knew that they knew about the motions of Venus before the Europeans did. And who knows what we could have learned had we, you know, just been a little smarter about invading another country. But such is life in the Dark Ages.
They had a mission in mind. You know, when they showed up and realized that, you know, the Maya had a very plentiful element that is gold, and it could be hammered very, very thin, and it could be written on very easily, and it never rusted, it never oxidized, so it stayed new-looking year after year after year. And, of course, when the conquistadors arrived, that was their wealth, and so they melted it all down into links of chains, and they actually had over 700 barge trains. These are sailing vessels that pull barges across the sea back to Spain, and over 700 of these sunk in the Gulf of Mexico, just to give you an idea how much gold they hauled out of there. And they didn't mine it. They melted the libraries down.
Yeah, what a tragedy. Yeah, there's other gold there, too, that you know, they're still haven't discovered, and I mean that metaphorically, but I write about it briefly at the back of Lost Star of Myth and Time. Terra Preta do Indio, are you familiar with that soil they found in South America?
This is the living soil.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, it's they're finding these plots, and it's in 2 to 4 hectares, and it's a black soil versus this sort of yellower jungle soil. And, of course, the jungle soil is not very nutrient-rich. So when the natives down there come across this black soil, they get all excited because they know they can grow papayas in it or other cash crops, and they'll grow in a much shorter period of time, and the fruit will be far more plentiful. So it's a tremendous economic advantage. And the stuff will stay there as long as you don't take too much of it away. Anyway, they've found enough of these plots now that if you put them all together, it would be about the area of France. And most all of them have pottery shards in them. And it dates back, it's definitely pre-Columbian. I've seen some dates that go back about 9,000 years or so, although there's other anthropologists that dispute that. In any event, Cornell University has been there to study it, and they still do not know how to duplicate it. They know that it's kind of like a yogurt, that it has all these living organisms in it. I think it's 5 billion per cubic centimeter. But for some reason, we don't know how it sustains itself, how it just keeps going on. Anyway, it's one of these things left to us from a higher culture, has tremendous implications for feeding people, for making more productive lands, that we're just rediscovering nowadays and still don't know how to duplicate.
So what's really interesting about the soil is it's like super compost, but it's actually living soil, and you never deplete the minerals in it. You could just grow and grow and grow forever in it, and it will keep replenishing itself.
Yeah, and you don't, apparently it doesn't have to lie fallow like most fields do, and as long as you don't take away more than about half of it, it will replenish. You know, you can't go down too far.
You can't scoop it up with a front loader and trains and haul it off to Boise, Idaho, and enhance the growth and expect
good
to get it.
Good thing the conquistadors didn't discover it, I guess. Huh?
Well, the interesting thing about it is apparently because of the pottery shards. This is not naturally occurring. This is engineered soil.
Oh, exactly. And it's found in these fairly neat plots. So we know this was by some ancient civilization. And it's not too far from waterways, too. So obviously they were using rivers or tributaries to get around. And so, yeah, it fits all the patterns of a highly developed culture, which is not supposed to exist.
Well, you know, I just keep having these feelings that, those kinds of things were there, and the civilization were there. They had plenty to drink. They had obviously domesticated the growth of fruits and vegetables, so they had plenty to eat. They had complex language. They had a good understanding of astronomy, mathematics, architecture, social structure. And the question keeps coming up, where did they go? If they were that great then, where did they go? And it what it fits is, if you read this book, Lost Star of Myth and Time, you see that there is this, these yugas, these cycles of awakenness and awareness and oneness with the planet, and then there are these cycles of just stupidity. And maybe it's the same beings going through these cycles. It's not just, you know, we're born at the beginning of this new Bronze Age. It doesn't seem fair, does it, that we would all die before we get to see this golden age? What do you think, Walter?
I would agree with you. You're sort of speaking to the immortal nature of the soul or the consciousness that wears these bodies. And I'm with you there. It's just too bad that we can't remember most of us. And I heard a saint say once that you will remember your lives when you live a life worth remembering. And so,
yeah, but you don't want to be old and decrepit sitting in a creaky rocking chair in the retirement home trying to remember a life. It would seem to me that if we've got this realization that we would leave for our future selves some kind of time capsule, some kind of awareness evidence, so that as we come of age in the next 80 to 100 years, when all of us that are alive now are dead and it's a brand new race living on this planet, that we would be able to hand along some history book, some how-to manual of how to take off where we left off down here.
I would agree, and I think maybe there was some effort or attempt to do that with a lot of the megalithic structures. You know, why are these things built out of such immense stone, if not to last? And or in myth and folklore, which we have a very difficult time remembering, yet it was so important to so many ancient and even indigenous cultures that they would recite it word for word for word. You know, just back in the early 1900s, they were still finding, remote peoples. And Finland, for example, people from different sides of the country who had never met each other, they would recite the exact same myths. You could bring them together, they're word for word. Same thing going on in India. Why were these things so important that they had to be committed to memory like that?
Well, possibly an even more interesting question would be, what is the nature of the myths? It has to do with creation. Every single time, it has to do with the creation of the universe, the creation of the earth, and the relationship of man to it, over and over again, civilization after civilization, even modern cults. If you want to call them that, religious traditions, Mormons, Freemasons, they all speak of creation in their ceremonies over and over again.
You betcha. We want to know where we came from, why we're here, and where we're going. And that seems to be a common theme out there.
Sounds like the opening words of X Squared Radio. That's why we're here. That's why we reach out to everybody around the world with great guests like Walter. By the way, we'll give out the websites one more time. You know, this is a three-hour program, and if you're not getting all 3 hours, make sure to get a hold of us at X Squared Radio, and we'll take care of that with your affiliate. BBS Radio is the most widely listened to webcast network in the world, bar none, in the top 20,000 websites on the web. Our guest is Walter Cruttenden. His book is Lost Star of Myth and Time. And his websites are loststarbook.com. I believe I have that right. And the other is binaryresearchinstitute.org. And Walter, do you have any events coming up in the near future?
Yeah, I'd love to tell your listeners about the Conference on Procession and Ancient Knowledge. And that's an event we have each year. This will be the sixth annual. It'll be held at the National Academy of Sciences Beckman Center on the UCI campus. And we bring together the sort of leading scientists and author in this whole field of investigating how much the ancients really knew. And it takes place in October, but you can learn about it, who the speakers are, or find out about past topics by going to cpaconline.com. That's cpaconline.com.
Okay, we'll put a link to that on the website as well. That might be an event. No, that is an event I will be most interested in attending, to be sure. The greatest minds in the world researching something from physical and maybe metaphysical points of view. Very interesting.
Yeah, I know. All these hard scientists, we all end up getting into these deep philosophical, metaphysical conversations because it's where it leads you.
Well, you said it in your book. You know, it's the physicists that are going to lead the way. They're the new, I won't say they're the new, but they're certainly cracking off the ceramic coating on the outside of the myth and folklore that make up man's religions.
There you go. I think it's true. The times they are changing, as Mr. Dillon said.
Well, that's true, and we're involved in it. We are perhaps co-creators with these times, and we take responsibility for it, not afraid of it, and looking forward to it, are we not?
Yeah, and I think it's particularly important right now when you see kind of all the changes go in place, these economic changes, troubling times, and you know, to me, you can either get down and be negative and pessimistic about it, or you can be optimistic. You know, you have to sort of tear down the old institutions before the new ones can take their place. And I think that's what's going on right now. We're accelerating. The procession rate is increasing. So the rate of change is not just linear. It is exponential.
Right, right. Yeah, the rate of change is not like what we went through in 1929. That was perhaps an engineered economic collapse that evaporated the middle class. We're certainly not going to go through that. If we do, it will only last a few hours. We have much, much better communication than before, and unlike then, there's value in our system. We are actually doing stuff and making things. And that will mean that we will recover from this very quickly. So do not despair. Don't sell everything. Don't give up on the race of man yet. We have a lot to go.
Okay, I'm going to hang on. My grandfather was actually in the investment banking business back in the last Depression. And he found it a wonderful time, and he made a bundle. And what he was doing was he was buying bonds of defaulted companies, and he'd sell them back to the companies as they were redeeming them later on. And so I think there'll be good opportunities this time, too. And you're right, communications are a lot better, technology is a lot better, so hopefully we can get this whole thing a lot faster.
I think so too. There are some pretty good minds out there working on it, and it's not completely out of control. What makes it out of control is when we are out of control, and we are not. We are sovereign beings in charge of our own life condition. Walter, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the program. I definitely want to have you back, and keep up the good work and stay in touch with me.
I will do, Brooks, and thanks for having me on the show. And if you can make it out there to Irvine, California for our next conference on procession ancient knowledge, then you're my guest.
Ah, wonderful. I actually took a genetics class there in 1967. Yeah,
okay.
I know. I was only 12, but trust me, I took the class and I did pretty well in it. All right, that's it for us then. We're out. 3 hours goes so fast on this program, you can't believe it. Appreciate it. Have a wonderful week, my friend, and we'll be in touch.
Okay. Take care. Bye.
Thank you and good night. Well, there you have it, Earth Explorers, Walter Cruttenden, his book, Lost Star of Myth and Time. Don't forget about the 2012 Quantum Leap Conference coming up this weekend. Don't miss it. We'll be with you. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio, saying, peace, Earth Explorers.